New and exclusive on Disney Plus. Meet the powerhouse divorce lawyers.
Deep breath. Tell us your story.
Kim Kardashian, Naomi Watts, Sarah Paulson, and Glenn Close, who don't just play the game, they change it.
You can't tell us to stop.
This November.
Showtime, ladies.
Never settle.
Love and war.
All's fair. A new Hulu original series exclusively on Disney Plus. 18 plus subscription required. T's and C's apply.
Welcome back to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Adia Khan. I know it takes real effort to hit that play button, to decide you want to spend your time listening to what I have to say. So thank you. I see you, and I really appreciate your curiosity and openness. Before we dive in, just a quick reminder, we now have a channel on Apple Podcasts called Immigrantly Uninterrupted, and I would love for you to subscribe, not just because you'll get ad-free episodes. Honestly, who doesn't love that? But because your support helps keep these conversations like this one possible. And you know what? I know that you believe in the work, the content that we are creating, and I'm pretty sure you would want to help us. So here's where you help, by subscribing to Immigrantly Uninterrupted. Now, I've been thinking a lot lately about emotional endurance that women are often accused of having too much of. Sometimes when I get into a discussion with the men in my family and they feel like they're losing the argument, they'll say something like, "You're being too emotional." And yes, I am emotional during those times because I care deeply. I believe my emotionality helps me connect, ask questions other might sidestep, and sit with what I don't know yet. And today, I'm bringing that energy into a conversation with Dr. Lina Maria Murillo, author of Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. She is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Her work traces almost a century of struggle, movement, policy, and lived experience around reproductive care and control along the border. And she's here to help us understand today's battles over abortion, contraception, race. And I kid you not, this conversation was not what I expected, in a good way. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Lina, and thank you for giving me the permission to call you Lina instead of Dr. Lina.
No, of course. I appreciate being on your show today.
I will preface this conversation with, as I was doing research on you and your work, I kid you not, for a minute, I was like, I have to reorient my entire thinking around reproductive health, reproductive rights, reproductive care, control. Your research spans more than a century of reproductive care, right, in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. The focus is women of Mexican origin, but you do distinguish clearly between reproductive care and reproductive control. Let's start there.
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. And now I feel a little bit of pressure to come up with, oh my goodness, I never thought about myself necessarily flipping the script, but I'll say I define reproductive care in a different way. It's really for me kind of an outcropping of reproductive justice. So reproductive justice is a framework that was developed by women of color feminists, by Black feminists, Latinas, Asian activists, who were, I think, in the 1990s, feeling like the focus on abortion access was very limiting to the very real histories and contemporary experiences of women of color in the United States around their reproduction. Often when people have, in the last 50 years, fought for reproductive rights, it has been under the guise of having the choice not to have children. And what women of color were saying, well, that is certainly a concern of ours, right? To be able to decide when we have children and how many children we have and under what circumstances. But also, and importantly, it's about the right to have children. And focusing on the histories of coercive sterilization among Latinas, among Native women, among Black women throughout the 20th century. How do we make sense of not just the ability to decide when we don't want to have children, but also the ability to have children, right? And to have families. And then the last part of reproductive justice, which I think is very important, is the right to raise the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. And so for me, thinking about reproductive justice, I wanted to understand what that framework allows us to see about the past that we don't often get to see, in particular for women of color in the United States. So often the histories that we've been told and taught about sort of feminist organizing around reproductive rights is one that has often centered the stories of middle-class white women and their efforts to gain access to birth control, and then later their efforts to access abortion, that has marginalized the experiences of women of color in this country who have not been concerned in the same way white women have to have access to reproductive control. And so that to me was a very important framework and shifted how I understood the term reproductive care. The way that I'm defining reproductive care really is as a mode of community engagement, of mutual support and care around access to health and around access to building safe and sustainable communities in which children can live and thrive. And in particular, children who come from marginalized communities, right? Who have, whose families and mothers in particular have experienced for a greater part of the 20th century, deep marginalization due often to poverty and racism and sexism. And so it was with that framework that I began to look at the history of Mexican origin women along the US-Mexico border and look at their experiences, not only as quote-unquote victims of population control movements, namely by organizations like Planned Parenthood beginning in the 1930s, but also how they became active agents, not only within that organization, right? So utilizing the services of Planned Parenthood, despite the kind of language that the organization used in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and really into the 70s, they were heavily focused on population control rhetoric, targeting specifically the Mexican origin community in places like El Paso, Texas, which is the focus of my study, but also how they use those services for their own ends, and also how they began to create their own clinics and own spaces for care. And so I call that level of activism and organizing reproductive care, because it is not only about wanting to have some say over their bodies and engage in bodily autonomy, but also that they were reproducing spaces for community care and mutual support when the state was openly denying them access to resources that would allow them to be able to raise their children in safe and sustainable communities.
Lena, you also link this to the eugenics idea. So it's pretty much racialized. It's rooted in racial hierarchy of who is fit and supposed to have children. There's a dichotomy that you explore. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of this as you see it through the lens of eugenics ideology. How do you square this with the notion that there is scarcity of resources in the world? So if not population control, how do we ensure that everybody has adequate resources for themselves and for others? And I know this is just a very long question, and I'm sure as a prof, you can break it down. But let's start with the eugenics, and then let's deep dive into this idea of scarcity of resources.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that question. One that I hardly get asked, actually, when I do these sorts of interviews. So I'm looking forward to addressing the second part of the question. But I'll say, you know, the history of eugenics is a long one. It's one that is deeply rooted in American history. So these are ideas that while eugenics was a scientific movement that took over the world, most of its greatest thinkers are U.S. scholars. Right. I think oftentimes when this history is talked about, I think more for public consumption, people say, oh, this was a pseudoscience. We can think about it that way today. But at the time, these were, you know, men, academics, biologists, psychologists, physicians, educated at Harvard, at Princeton, at Yale in the 19th century, beginning in the 1850s and 1860s, thinking about evolution as an important discovery in, you know, in our natural world. And so you began to see people who were saying, well, what if we adapt this vision of evolution to society? What if we begin to look at societies at different levels on the sort of evolutionary hierarchy? And then what if we begin to look at those societies and begin to racialize the people within those societies, right? And of course, this is at a time when in the US, there is racialized chattel slavery, right? Where Black people are enslaved because they are Black. And eugenics comes at the point when there's a civil war in the United States and people are, you know, actively pushing back on these racialized notions of connecting servitude, perpetual servitude, life servitude to race. And so eugenics in some ways rises up, and many historians have written about this, as a way to kind of deal with this racialized society that exists because of sort of capitalist exploitation and to make sense of it after slavery is gone. We still need a rationale, and what better rationale than science, right? When we can naturalize this, just look at the natural world, right? And this is what many of the scientists did, and, you know, measuring people's craniums to their noses to their faces to decide where on this hierarchy of humanity people fit. And these ideas go into the 20th century. And, you know, many people understand that the Holocaust, the late 1930s and into the 1940s and World War II is kind of the sort of the greatest expression of like extreme, you know, eugenics gone unchecked. Those ideas never go away. They go underground, right? Because of the Holocaust. And so one of the things that I'm doing in my book, Fighting for Control, is essentially tracing that lineage of thinking after the end of World War II. One of the first people to write a book about the scarcity of resources is a man by the name of William Boyd, who writes a book in 1948. So literally just 3 years after the end of World War II. His book is called Road to Survival. And one of the main characters in his book, Road to Survival, is a Mexican woman. She's the only woman in the book. And he sort of uses her as an example of, you know, this poor, likely indigenous woman of Mexico. People in her village suffer high infant mortality rates because they're a developing nation that likely because of their sort of racial mixing will never actually, like, you know, fully be able to climb the hierarchy of human progress. And so, like, what do we do with these people who are just essentially born to suffer? They're bad luck of being born on that particular, that in that particular space on the racial hierarchy. And he says they're using resources that could go to others, right? Who might otherwise make more use of these resources. But oftentimes these population control advocates would downplay, right? Because they didn't want to be called racist. And a lot of their letters and a lot of their communication, they would say this privately, right? We don't really want to put forth the proper racial argument for why we're concerned about population growth predominantly in the global South, because people will call us racist and no one will actually pay attention to our ideas. The notion of scarcity of resources is always a fascinating one because it often comes from the global North, a place that overuses the resources that are on our planet that are scarce in ways that people in the global South wouldn't ever dream of doing, right? And so one of the critiques that oftentimes people in the reproductive justice movement make of these population control conversations is that never in these conversations is capitalism under question or attack, or the overaccumulation by a very small percentage of people on this planet of resources that could be better used by people all over the world. This is when you begin to critique the hoarding of wealth, for instance. When you have people saying, well, why do we have billionaires? I mean, that's a wonderful question. Why do we have billionaires?
Why do we have them exactly?
Well, exactly, where you have literally a small community. I mean, 10, maybe 15 men, they're all men, who are hoarding something like 90% of the world's money. And then because they have such extreme access to wealth, have control over the world's resources. These are not elected officials. Nobody chose them to hoard this much wealth. And yet their consumption and their use of their wealth is never under scrutiny, and certainly not their reproduction, right? I'll name one of them. Elon Musk, I think, has something like 14 children as of this point. Never is his reproduction under scrutiny in the way that, you know, mothers, for instance, in places like Sudan right now, that is under threat. So to me, it's a lack of the historical understanding of these movements. The men who are part of this population control movement are part of the global North. Many of them scholars, people like Paul Ehrlich, who is often known for his book, The Population Bomb, which came out in 1968, and a professor at Stanford University for many years. And, you know, he's one of these people that popularized this notion. Like, what do we do with the impoverished people of the global South who are using all of these resources? But again, never in their calculations are they taking into account the people in the global North who are using extreme amounts of resources. And these calculations have been done mostly by environmental justice advocates who say we would be able to manage our resources much better were it not for the global North using way more than their fair share.
This is such an interesting conversation, Lina, and I have so many thoughts. I grew up in Pakistan, and there was always this narrative of population explosion. It still is. Pakistan is a poor country, not in resources, but otherwise. And people do argue that in Pakistan, if somebody who's living in poverty has 6 or 7 children, they can't sustain them. They can't give them the quality of education, life, that they could otherwise if they had 1 or 2 kids. And that's the argument that's often presented as a rationale for population control. And to your point about Elon Musk, some may argue he is a billionaire. If he has 14 children, so what, right? He can afford to give them the kind of life that they deserve. So my question to you is, when we talk about population control in countries like Pakistan, and again, I'm taking this conversation from Mexico to Pakistan, how do we justify people having 7, 8 kids, right? And that's a choice that they make, given that in our calculus, they won't be able to take care of those 7, 8 children. How does your research fit into that reality?
So to go back to your initial statement, I'm hoping the work that I'm doing, the work that my colleagues in the reproductive justice movement are doing, is to reframe these kinds of conversations. Part of the power of population control was that it instilled, I mean, because this was a global movement, right? I mean, what you're talking about in Pakistan, you know, India was kind of ground zero in many ways for these conversations on an international level. People like Margaret Sanger traveled to India many times, held some of the most important population sort of research conferences were in India. And so, of course, these conversations would trickle from India into Pakistan and the surrounding countries as a way to mitigate poverty. So as a way to individualize, it was a way to individualize concerns for poverty. You as an individual, I mean, this is a very American
way of understanding
poverty, but you as an individual, it is your fault.
It's your fault, your responsibility.
It is your fault that you're poor. It is not the state's fault that you're poor. It is not global forces, right, that are stripping, as you beautifully stated, we are not poor in resources. If you look at many countries in the global south, they are not poor in resources. They're incredibly wealthy in resources. They are poor in resources because those resources have been stripped from their country in order to serve concerns of the global north. And so if resources were equitably managed in all of our countries, my family's from Colombia, one of the richest resource-rich countries in Latin America, but yet some of the countries that deal with some of the most horrific forms of poverty, right? Like this is directly connected to history of imperialism, right? Again, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, where there has been massive resource extraction from our countries. Again, how do you justify the level of poverty in some of our countries? Well, you launch this global movement that says it is your responsibility as an individual, right? If you want to be part of this liberal experiment of democracy, part of that is that you need to take responsibility. And it begins at the very basis of your sense of humanity, which is your reproduction and your ability to have a family and have children. And so there you deflect responsibility for poverty from the state and you force it onto individuals. It is no longer the fault of the state for essentially allowing countries to be stripped of their resources. But it is now each individual's fault for having too many children, for why they are in poverty.
It's such an interesting lens. I never thought of it that way. So tell me, as a researcher, do you think we have a population explosion problem in this world?
No. We have a resource accumulation problem in this world, right? We have countries like the United States, like Europe, that hoard their resources and hoard their material wealth at the expense of others. So earlier you mentioned, oh, Elon Musk, he's a billionaire. So what if he has 14 children? I mean, the so what is, if one of his 14 children is living in a McMansion that is using up water, electricity, such that it could power a small town in Pakistan, then it is my problem.
Yeah, I was being devil's advocate. I don't like Elon Musk at all.
my point is that is what I'm hoping terms like reproductive care, when they're fully fleshed out, begin to do. That if we engage in thinking about that third prong of reproductive justice, which is collectively, it is about collectivity, saying, no, we are a collective. We are in a collective planet. We don't have another one, despite his best efforts at us traveling to Mars and potentially destroying that planet and ruining its resources. But understanding our sense of responsibility to each other, even if we are thousands of miles away, right? That the resource extraction and the overuse of resources in one place do affect our brothers and sisters and siblings on the other side of the planet. And that in order to mediate that, in order to understand how we remedy this issue is through deep collective organizing and through deep collective care, reproductive care, producing sustainable communities in which all of our children whether we decide that we want to have no children or we want to have 7 children. That is our human right to do so. And we should not be shamed.
It's a woman's bodily autonomy. A woman should not be pressured into wanting to have children or not wanting to have children. You also talk about this notion of desirability and how it links to Eurocentric procreation. So what we are seeing right now unfolding in the US, it's by design, right? It's to encourage white folks to have more children and hence overturning of Roe versus Wade, and at the same time preventing access to reproductive care overall to women of color. So this is again an extension of population control that you've talked about time and again, right? Can you talk a little bit about what you have discovered through your research when it comes to what's happening in the US?
Absolutely. It's actually quite frightening. I give a lot of talks on this subject. And so I ask often audience members to, you know, on the one hand, hold the discourse of the current administration of the federal government on the one hand, and then look at their actions. I encourage those who are listening to think and to engage, you know, as researchers do. One is what people say and one is what people do. And when we put those together, what kind of vision are they constructing for our society? So let's first talk about what they're saying. They are saying that people need to have more children. Recently, Dr. Oz said that the U.S. is under-babied. That was a term he used.
That don't have the number of babies they desire. They're under-babied. So this president committed to address that. Now, I know what you're all thinking, and you're probably right. There are going to be a lot of Trump babies. I think that's probably a good thing. But it turns out
he gave like a big press conference and he said, you know, we at the Trump administration wants to support people in having more children because we are underbabied. And so one of the ways that they're going to do that is by offering some sort of monetary compensation for every baby born. They're going to give people like $2,000 for those people who have had children in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. You can spend $2,000 literally, right, in less than a month and a half, not just in, you know, buying diapers and clothes and maybe formula and car seat, crib and all of these things. But let's say you have a difficult birth and your insurance will not cover all of the services that you may have needed to have your child. Many people go into debt, huge amounts of debt. So $2,000 is ridiculous, right? It's not going to help the average person. So what is that kind of financial support supposed to do? Or what is that supposed to signal, right? Okay, so that's one thing. And they've also said, oh, we're going to give you a medal. That's what they've offered thus far, right? So that's on the one hand. And again, lots of discourse around why it's so important to have children. On the other hand, they have, as you were mentioning, we've seen this state by state, even before the Trump administration came into power in 2016, we had already seen an unleashing of laws across the country, state by state, that was dismantling access to reproductive health. Because oftentimes some clinics lose the ability to provide abortion care. They also come under financial distress. And so they lose the ability to offer other forms of care, like prenatal care, postnatal care, access to cancer screenings, access to sexually transmitted infection screenings, right? And then all of a sudden, these clinics close down. And so these laws help to perpetuate the loss of spaces to acquire the most basic kinds of reproductive health care, so that at some point, a person might be healthy enough to want to have a child. So that's already happening. At the same time, they're also saying we're not going to study the effects of the loss of this healthcare. The Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr., they've announced like, we're not going to study maternal health outcomes. We're not going to study maternal mortality outcomes. We're not going to study infant mortality outcomes. So whether or not a child survives past their first birthday, we are not going to study these things. We're not going to keep records of this information. States themselves have dismantled. Georgia famously did so earlier this year. They said, we're no longer going to keep statistics on maternal and infant mortality. So on the one hand, they're like, we want you to have more babies. But on the other hand, they're saying, we're not going to study or care about or keep track of whether or not people are dying from pregnancy. And disproportionately from what we do know that has been studied in the last 5 to 10 years is that maternal mortality disproportionately falls on the backs of Black women and increasingly on Latinas in the United States. The very, very wealthy, the people that will never be affected by any of these issues, right? And the people who end up, you know, who tend to be wealthy are often white. Not always, but majority of them are often wealthy and white. And so this is, as you were saying, right? This is an inversion of this sort of eugenic rationale. Not only that, but we're also going to downplay the efficacy of vaccines and vaccination, which, as we know, I mean, my goodness, we know this. This is not in need of more scientific research. We know that vaccines save lives. And when you deny people access to vaccines, right, through like when the federal government is saying, actually, we don't need these, and insurance companies say, well, then we're not going to provide them, then what you begin to see is that people who get their healthcare through their work will have a more difficult time accessing, again, very basic forms of healthcare, right, that oftentimes we don't think as reproductive healthcare, but they are, because if you are a pregnant person, you are more susceptible to getting some of these diseases that can have long-term effects on your fetus, right? On your child. We know this about measles. We know this now. They're starting to come out with information about COVID. If you are a pregnant person and you had COVID, your children are more susceptible to autism. It is kind of like enraging, and pardon me for getting worked up about this. But it is enraging, right? When they are saying we would like people to have more children, but then they are essentially gutting all of the supports for the poor. And eugenics, if anything, even in the early turn of the 20th century, was not just a racial attack, a racialized attack, but it was very much an attack on the poor. The majority of people in the United States that were sterilized from the turn of the 20th century into the 19th century, by proportion, right, of the population, were poor white people. And certainly Latinas had some of the highest numbers of coercive sterilizations proportionate to their population numbers. But in overall numbers, the majority of people in this country that were sterilized against their wishes, right, coercively sterilized, were white people.
So that's what I was going to ask you, because it seems like, first of all, they are denying reproductive care under the guise of, as you explain it, okay, having more children, but then denying access to reproductive care, because they are really distinguishing in their mind and their calculus on socioeconomic status, right? So the assumption here is that wealthier people are probably more white, and hence they will have access to reproductive care in any case, and they are betting on that. But what's ironic in all of this, as you already stated, is that then poor white women become collateral damage in all of this equation for them, right? Because they do want white women to procreate, but it's okay for poor white women to face the brunt of it alongside poor Black and brown women, as long as more wealthy white women are able to reproduce, right?
Absolutely. If we put all of this together, they're not hiding their intention. I mean, it's very clear. The fact that they are gutting, with the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill, that they are gutting Medicaid and they are gutting SNAP. I mean, right now, at this very moment, today is November 6th, people have been 6 days without their SNAP benefits. again, proportionate to the society, the majority of the people on SNAP are poor white people. And they voted for this because oftentimes folks don't understand, right, the repercussions. They think that they're talking about somebody else, right? When they use undocumented immigrants, by they, I mean politicians, use undocumented immigrants as the avatars for the undeserving, for the ones that are taking things that they don't, like, that's an avatar. These horrific attacks against the immigrant community, it's all for show, right? Like these public displays, these spectacles of public violence, of forced disappearances, it is to show that poor white electorate, look, we are doing something in your name, at the same time that with the other hand, they're taking away all of the benefits that keep those poor white people alive.
But the script here is that poor white folks have these aspirational ideas of what could be, right? So it's almost as if in a capitalistic society, people don't see themselves where they are. They sometimes aspire to be where they want to be. Hence, the policy debate and the policy understanding, it will eventually benefit us because we want to aspire to be like Elon Musk's of the world. And that's the irony, right? It's not your current state. It's what the future holds or what they are promising you in the future.
Yes, that is certainly. And I mean, that is one aspect of it. And the other is that the pull of white supremacy is very strong. It's very powerful. It provides the necessary cover so that people vote against their best economic interests if they're able to align themselves with a notion of aspirational whiteness.
Exactly.
That they may never attain, right? And so that is that.
It's proximity to whiteness.
And that positionality. I often talk to people, I'm like, why do we feel a greater sense of allegiance to someone like Jeff Bezos than the people working in his factories? People are like, oh my God, leave him alone. Why do you feel a greater sense of allegiance to him than you do to the people who, again, because this has been documented, journalists have documented, than people who have to pee in a Coke bottle because they're not given enough time to go to the bathroom in one of his Amazon factories? Like, how did we get here, right?
Lena, why aren't people in the media or in policy realm, like think tanks, educational institutions, talking about this?
I mean, I think that they are happening in the media, not maybe legacy media, but certainly in spaces like we're in today, right? Where you have people who are venturing out to have different conversations than what we hear in legacy media spaces, whether you're talking about CNN or MSNBC or Fox News but I do think people are having these conversations. We are talking about these critiques in academia, and that's precisely why academia right now is so under attack.
So is there any hope?
I mean, I'll say this. I encourage debate and conversation in my classes. Oftentimes, I find that is when students are best able to articulate their positions. As a historian, I often ask students to be sure that they cite their sources. What are your sources? How are you coming to this conclusion? What kind of analysis did you do? Are they vetted sources?
I love that.
My research is on the history of abortion and reproductive health. For me, I am committed to seeking the truth for the betterment of our society. I'm committed to truth-telling and truth-seeking as an academic, as a researcher, as a historian, and especially as a teacher. And I've had students in my class who are conservative students and who will say to me, like, I'm feeling very nervous about having this conversation because I feel like I'm not going to be able to say the things that I want to say. And I'm like, okay, well, like, let's see how it happens. And then afterwards, they'll come up to me and they're like, oh, I actually didn't feel as defensive as I was going to be, because I wasn't expecting you to focus on these things. In fact, these are things I had no idea existed in this history. And it actually caused me to kind of think more deeply. It hasn't changed how I feel about this particular topic. I still feel very strongly, but it's actually opened my eyes to these other things that I had never considered.
And for critical thinking, right? I do want to get your take on Mexico Supreme Court's decriminalization of abortion federally, Lena. What's the biggest misconception Americans have when they hear Mexico is legal now? What does that mean? And how should we interpret that?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you so much. Well, there are several things. One, and let me just start by praising the work of feminists in Mexico and really feminists in Latin America who came together at, you know, at different junctures in the last 20, 30 years and began to articulate a vision of gender-based violence, something that is a term that is used by the UN, that was brought to the UN by feminists in the global South to articulate not just violence in a war zone, but to encapsulate the denial of access to healthcare as gender-based violence. And this is what is called the Green Wave in Latin America, was this connection of the loss of access to abortion and lack of access to contraception as a form of gender-based violence. And so the president of the Supreme Court in Mexico for over a decade had been very attuned to these demands. And so slowly but surely has been kind of rolling out a new vision for reproductive health access in Mexico. And so there are still states in Mexico, like in the United States, where it's very difficult for people to access abortion. Feminists have created incredible underground networks of support for people to be able to access medication abortion. I know that there's an important, actually, I think it's a US-backed clinic that has opened an abortion clinic in Cancun. So you can like go to Cancun and access abortion care if you need to. There's a clinic there now. And so I think that for people in the US, when that news first broke, I remember I was getting a lot of journalists calling, you know, asking me, what, you know, is it true? Are women in the US going to be going to Mexico to get abortion care? And I was like, yeah, and they've been doing that. I mean, like, travel across the U.S.-Mexico border, and really travel across the U.S.-Canada border, is riddled with stories of people trying to get access to healthcare. Why? Because healthcare in the United States is prohibitive. Unless you have insurance and the right kind of insurance, you can get into massive amounts of debt, right? I mean, this is the thing that like Bernie Sanders has been like the millionaires and the billionaires. He has been one of those people that has been very consistent about pointing out the way that pharmaceutical companies in the US take advantage of US consumers, right? So people have been traveling to Mexico for access to all kinds of healthcare, including now reproductive healthcare. And what people are finding is a fairly robust system of feminist organizers who are there to help meet their needs. And what it has caused among feminist scholars and feminist activists in the US is to say, we have a lot to learn about organizing from our Latin American sisters in the South that have been very inclusive in thinking about gender-based violence as a loss of gender-affirming care, right? So to include trans and non-binary people in their movement and to say that, you know, loss of gender-based healthcare is a form of gender-based violence, and loss of access to reproductive care is also a form of gender-based violence. I think that reframing is incredible because it has actually moved the needle. And so, you know, I'll just say we have a lot to learn from organizing and discourse and framing from our siblings in the global South right now.
I love it, Lena. And in the end, if you were to define the United States of America, how would you do that?
Right now, we are We are living a moment that I think is shocking to a lot of people who never thought that we would be on the precipice of losing so much. I think people have sadly, and this is one of the things that I try to combat as a historian, have a vision of this progressive notion of history, that history just, without us doing anything, will just always get better. Life will always get better. Things just get better, without understanding that the reason why we have these moments where things do get better is because human beings, we as a collective, have come together to fight for them and to demand that we be treated with dignity and care and support. And so I think that this is one of those moments where people are looking around and saying, oh, now is the time to organize. Now is the time to fight. And I think one of the most heartening spaces where I see that happening is actually around immigration and immigrant detention and raids, where you have people in local neighborhoods coming out and saying, like, no, you will not take my neighbor. No, I will put my body physically in the way of you and these masked people who we don't know. Are they part of the federal government? Are they ICE? Are they DHS? Like, we don't know. Who are coming and trying to take away our community members. Like, that is the level of reproductive care that we need to engage in right now. And so I think people are starting to wake up to it and understand that it is up to us as members of our community, and that the work that we do, even in our towns, in our neighborhoods, and in our cities, that it reverberates around the world.
Thank you so much, Lena. Where can people find your book?
Oh, you can get book at any local bookstore. And if they don't have it, just go in and ask for Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. I have my website, linammurillo.com. You can look for all of my writing. Most of my writing is on there. I think just like PDFs of it, so you don't have to go through any firewalls to get my writing. So, people can reach out to me there.
Thank you so much, Lena. This was so good. Thank you for coming on Immigrantly.
Thank you, Sadia. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
So Lena and I continued our conversation after the interview, and she said something that really resonated with me about her students. And I'm paraphrasing here. So basically what she said was that a lot of times students look at things through this sliver, and she's trying to pull back the curtain and show them the whole picture. And you know what? It's up to us, not just students, but individuals and societies, that once the curtain is pulled back, we take all that information in and we do the critical thinking and the work to understand how power moves, who benefits, who loses. And again, we don't have to agree fully with each other, but as long as we understand each other's perspective a bit more, I think we'll be in good shape. Thank you for listening to my conversation with Lena. Thank you again for coming back, to those who come back every week. I really appreciate your presence, and do write to me if you have thoughts on this or any other episode. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is the amazing Lou Raskin. Theme music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation.